Hello, English-speaking world. My name is Eduardo. I'm part of a Brazilian podcast called Passadorama. In an American accent, I think it would be called Passadorama or something like that. But, well, you may call it whatever you like. First of all, I'd like to explain what this is, because if you don't live in Brazil and don't speak Portuguese, I'm guessing you don't know anything about our podcast. Our regular show is recorded in Portuguese and released once a month. It's a roundtable discussion about history, culture, and politics with our team, which is made up of journalists and historians. We also include snippets or sound bits of interviews with researchers who specialize in that month's theme. Some of those interviews are later released in their original form and length in a show we call Drops. This is one of those. It's the full version of the interview we recorded with Reza Aslan. He's an Iranian writer and scholar who lives and teaches in the United States, and is the author of, among other works, the books Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, and God, A Human Story. I interviewed Professor Aslan for our December 24th show, which was kind of a parody of a Christmas episode. In it, we talked about Jesus of Nazareth as a historical figure. As some of you may know, bits of this interview were dubbed in Portuguese and included in that episode. The program you're about to listen to now is the complete version of that interview in its original form in English. Another version of the complete interview dubbed in Portuguese is also available online on our podcast feed. Well, I'd really like to thank Professor Aslan for his participation. He was really nice to us, and his assistant Safa as well for all her help. That being said, I hope you all enjoy the show and wish every one of you a happy new year.
It's very nice to speak with you.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'm actually thrilled to be interviewing you because I really loved your book.
Oh, thank you.
It's been a great inspiration for us in our show. We're doing kind of a Christmas parody of an episode. Yeah.
That's great to hear. I think I'm going to come to Brazil probably, I want to say maybe April or May. It's for one of the book festivals. Hopefully I'll get to see you face to face.
Wow, that would be amazing. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I would love that.
So, first of all, Christianity has a lot of political power here in Brazil. Christian preachers and televangelists have great power in our media and are very influential in our politics and elections. Usually, whenever I hear the name Jesus by the mouth of a politician, I hear it as something used to defend conservative ideas.
Mm-hmm.
In your book, however, you portray Jesus as a sort of revolutionary figure, the historical Jesus. So how did we get here? How did Jesus become such a conservative idea these days? How did it change so radically?
Well, first of all, I know exactly what you're going through, because if there's any country in which Jesus is as much a political figure as he is in Brazil, it's the United States.
Yeah.
And certainly the same thing holds true here, where we have self-proclaimed devout followers of Jesus who, in almost every aspect of their lives, violate almost everything that Jesus preached upon. I mean, I remind you that we are currently under the leadership of a man, Donald Trump, who is the living embodiment of everything Jesus preached against. If you took Jesus's woes, you know, his woe to yous, and you turned it into a human being, you would have Donald Trump. And yet, this is a man, this thrice divorced lech, this greedy, racist, sexist, pathological liar, this narcissistic sociopath who cages children and has sex with porn stars a few days after his wife gives birth and then lies about it. This man has the support of nearly 80% of America's white evangelical Christians. It's astonishing. And I think for a lot of people, for a lot of non-Christians, they look at these things. They look at the way that Jesus is used by politicians, by political leaders, and by religious leaders to promote values that are so against everything Jesus preached. And they throw up their hands and they say, well, it's all hypocrisy. It's all nonsense. There's no reason to take either Christianity or Jesus seriously when these are the people who are representing him. And I completely understand that. The important thing to understand, of course, is that from the very beginning, Jesus has been what we say in English, a cipher. He's always been somebody that people essentially use as a mirror to reflect themselves. They see him as a rabbi or a revolutionary. They see him as somebody who gives deference to the state, somebody who fights against the state. You can basically make Jesus be whoever you want him to be. And that, more than anything else, is why I wanted to write this book. Because although Jesus the Christ can be whoever we want him to be, Jesus the man was someone very specific. He was someone who lived in a time and place. And if you remove him from that time and place, if you pretend that Jesus is speaking to you instead of a particular audience 2,000 years ago, then you'll never truly understand what he meant, what his life was about. So when you do that, when you look at Jesus in his time and place, it's impossible not to see him as someone whose entire ministry was predicated on the poor and the dispossessed, the marginalized, the weak. Even many progressive Christians, even liberal Christians, often get it wrong because they see Jesus as someone who was promoting equality, promoting the idea that all people are equal and all people are the same. Jesus never said any such thing. Jesus was not promoting social equality. Jesus was promoting the reversal of the social order. Jesus didn't say the rich and the poor should hold hands and sing kumbaya. Jesus said the rich and the poor should switch places. Woe to the rich, for they shall become poor. Woe to those who are fed, for they shall be hungry. Woe to those who rejoice, for they shall mourn. And then on the flip side of that, blessed are the poor, for the kingdom of God is theirs. What he wanted to see is the people at the top and the people at the bottom switching places. And that, as you can imagine, was a revolutionary idea, an idea that got him killed, an idea that many people today, many devout followers of Jesus today, simply ignore because of the obvious social and political ramifications of it. It's really funny to me because in a way, I think we have a very huge conversation here in the United States right now about immigration and about particularly about refugees. We in the United States have, you know, we like to call ourselves a country of immigrants. We are all immigrants here, and we have had our doors open, particularly to refugees who are refugees because of American foreign policy, either in Latin America or in the Middle East. And yet today, the group in America that is most likely to say that America should close its borders to refugees, women and children fleeing violence and persecution, the group that is most likely to say that we should close our borders altogether is white evangelical Christians. And if there's anything that Jesus said that should ring a bell to these people, it's the notion of welcoming the poor, the dispossessed, the widow, the orphan. And I think that in and of itself tells you just how easy it is to manipulate Jesus in order to fit whatever your own, you know, ideas are. I will say one thing. I just want to say one thing, Eduardo, which I think is very important. And I think this is as true in Brazil as it is in the United States, that particularly among young Christians, what I have been seeing is an attempt to start fighting back against this particular vision of Jesus. You know, we like to pretend sometimes in America that the only thing Jesus cared about was abortion and gay people. Two things, by the way, that Jesus never said anything about, either abortion or gay people. You know what Jesus did talk about? Healing the sick, feeding the hungry, caring for the poor. And I think a lot of young evangelical Christians now, because of the way that their parents' generation has so, you know, divorced Jesus' actual teachings from, you know, the world that they live in, what I see is a real backlash, an attempt to reclaim some of that, the revolutionary notions that Jesus preached for 2,000 years ago. So, you know, I have faith is what I'm trying to say, that young followers of Jesus are going to reclaim that original message. That's partly why I wanted to write the book.
Well, thank you for writing the book.
You're welcome.
Well, I've just started reading your new book, actually, which is titled God, A Human Story. I'm in the beginning, so please don't tell me how it ends, because no spoilers.
Yes, no spoilers, but no spoilers.
In it, you describe yourself as a believer in God. However, in your work as an academic, a researcher, and a professor, I imagine you constantly have to deal with religious texts and teachings with a skeptical approach.
Yes.
Do you perceive these two things as a contradiction or a paradox? How do you see them?
Well, first of all, I always try to explain to people that faith is first and foremost an emotion. It's an emotion the way that love is an emotion. If you try to rationalize love, why do I love someone? You know, where does that love come from? It doesn't make any sense. And I think it's the same is true with regard to faith. Faith is not a rational response to the world. It's an emotional response to the world. It should be an emotional response. There's nothing wrong with that. Our emotions are valid and justified and should be celebrated. And so that's the first thing that I think is very important to understand, is that my faith comes from my personal experiences as a human being, the relationships that I've formed, the way that I understand myself and my place in the world, the way that I understand the universe and my emotional response to it. My faith is ultimately a refusal to accept that reality is solely contained in the material world, that there is an experience of reality that goes beyond just the material world, and that I can access that reality, that I can commune with it. That's what I call my faith. And that doesn't bother me at all. I mean, I study the world's religions. I, first of all, know the difference between faith and religion. They're not the same thing. Faith, as I said, is personal and individualistic, and it's emotional. Religion is the language that we use to express faith. And just like, you know, the difference between Portuguese and English, it's two different languages, but the sentiment that is being expressed is the same. And I'm interested as much in the language as I am in the sentiment. And I've studied enough religions in the world to know that in the end, you know, what a lot of these religions are saying is pretty much the same thing. At the same time, I've never, ever been interested in the question of whether God exists or not, right? I'm not interested in that question because there's no proof either way. There is no proof for the existence or the non-existence of God. And as I say in the book, anyone who tells you otherwise is trying to convert you. Faith is a choice. It's an emotion. It's individualistic. And it has to do with, you know, the person and how that person understands the world. What I'm interested in and what this book is truly about is not, is there a God or not? My question is, what do we mean when we use the word God? You know, this word, which is a word that everybody uses, everybody tosses this word around as though we all mean the same thing by it, you know? You know, people ask me all the time, do you believe in God? My answer is always, what do you mean by God? I mean, the assumption that you and I mean the same thing when we say God is absurd. Of course we don't mean the same thing. And so I'm interested in how God has been defined throughout human history. And the conclusion that I draw in this book, which, by the way, was as surprising to me as it is to a lot of people who read it, is that more often than not, when we use the word God, when we conceive of God in our minds, what we are actually conceiving is essentially a divine version of ourselves. What we see is ourselves. We create a God who looks and thinks and acts and feels just like we do. We put all of our human emotions, all of our human attributes upon God, and then create this superhuman being who looks just like we do, who thinks just like we do, but who is limitless in power. And it's for this reason, going back to our first conversation about Jesus, it's for this reason that people can have two wildly contradictory notions of what Jesus meant. That you can have two people go to the same scripture at the exact same time and walk away with two radically opposing views of it. It's because we're not really talking about a being called God. We're really talking about ourselves. It's our prejudice that we put on God. It's our politics that we put on God. It's our economic views that we put on God. We make God a divine version of ourselves. And by the way, this has been true since the beginning of human history. In fact, as I explain in the book, it's actually hardwired in our brain. We don't have much choice in the matter. We're compelled to think of God in these terms.
Wow. Deep. Here I was expecting you to finally answer my question, is there a God or not?
Good luck with that. Yeah.
I'm not even going to finish the book now because, you know, just kidding. Well, coming back to Zealot, you describe Jesus as having around 72 disciples. I think that's in the Gospel of Luke.
In the Gospel of Luke, yeah.
Yeah, many of whom were women. And we don't hear a lot about these women disciples, such as Mary Magdalene. Well, you mentioned her in your book. What can you tell us about the role and participation of women in the Jesus movement?
Yeah, you know, for many, many, many years, especially at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a real attempt to try to reclaim the role of women in the Jesus movement. But really, ever since the discovery of the Gnostic Gospels and a lot of archaeological finds that show images, actual paintings of women in the early church, we now know pretty clearly that in that first century or so, first couple of centuries of early Christianity, women had very powerful leadership positions in the Jesus movement. They played roles as quote-unquote deacons. They were ministers. They basically were holders of the tradition. And this was based primarily upon the fact that Jesus himself had many female disciples. In fact, it's kind of shocking that at least five or six of them are named in the Gospels, whether it's, as you say, Mary of Magdala, who was not a prostitute. There is not a single verse, not a single verse in the entire Bible that calls Mary Magdalene a prostitute, and yet for some reason, that has become, you know, who she is. And by the way, it's a way to diminish her leadership position.
Yes, certainly.
Whether it's someone who the Bible refers to as, quote, the other Mary, whether it's Martha or Joanna. Joanna was a very wealthy woman who basically bankrolled the Jesus movement, right? I mean, she paid for all the food and the travel and the housing, you know, as this group moved from town to town, village to village. These women were as important and as consequential as anyone else in the Jesus movement. Now, the one important distinction is between the apostles and the disciples, right? So the Gospel of Luke says that there were around 72 disciples, but there were only 12 apostles. And the real difference between a disciple and an apostle is that an apostle had the ability to preach independently of Jesus. The disciples followed Jesus, you know, from town to town. They preached along with him. They taught with him. The apostles were empowered to teach and preach apart from Jesus. And those 12 were all men. And whether that's deliberate or not, that has had a huge effect, obviously, in the creation of the church and the excising of women in leadership positions in the church. But the scriptures, the archaeology, the textual evidence that we have are all unanimous in showing the profound position of leadership that women enjoyed, not just in Jesus's movement while he was alive, but in the first and second centuries after his death.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
What about Judas? You don't write a lot about Judas in your book, but I was wondering about him because he's always pictured in the Passion plays as this figure who betrays Jesus at Gethsemane. But there are also some other views of him in popular culture, like in the Martin Scorsese movie, I don't remember the title of it, and in Jesus Christ Superstar and things like that. They try to depict him as a more of a three-dimensional character. And what do we know about the historical Judas? Can you tell me about him?
Well, we don't know much about him. Now, a few decades ago, we discovered a document called, that we now refer to as the Gospel of Judas. It was,
it's a Gnostic
text. That's right. Yeah. Gnostic text. I believe it was either a 3rd or 4th century text. And that gospel goes through great lengths to try to salvage Judas by making his betrayal of Jesus a sacrifice. It was part of Jesus's plan all along. You can understand the theology behind that idea. I mean, there is no salvation without Jesus's sacrifice. There is no sacrifice without Jesus's betrayal. And so the person who betrays him, in a way, becomes a heroic figure, right? The one that actually allows for salvation to happen. And in the Gospel of Judas, he is seen as doing this at the behest, at the command of Jesus himself. It's Jesus who sends Judas out in order to bring the Roman troops and have him arrested. But of course, the problem with those manuscripts, 3rd, 4th century manuscripts, is that they're written really as apologetics. They're written, hundreds of years after the event. They definitely have a political dimension to them. By the way, I just want to clarify, that's true of the Gospels too. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are also political documents. They are also apologetics. But as I described at the very beginning of Zealot, the only way that you can get as close to the real Jesus as possible is to rely on the very first texts that were written about him. And so for me, I use the Gospel of Mark, which was written sometime around 70 AD, so about 35, 40 years after Jesus's death. And then a collection that we just refer to as Q, which is basically the material that the Gospels of Matthew and Luke have in common with each other, but that isn't in Mark. The theory is that this was a text, a collection of Jesus's sayings, a kind of quote book, if you will, that was compiled sometime around the year 50. Those are the only two texts that I use in order to construct the life of Jesus. Everything after that, whether it's the Gospel of Matthew and Luke, both of which were written in the 90s, or the Gospel of John, which was written the earliest in about 100, maybe as late as 110, 120. At that point, there's a thing called Christianity now, right? When Mark is written, there's no such thing as Christianity. It just doesn't, it's not a thing, really. It's still the Jesus movement. And so the further you get from Jesus, the less trustworthy the text becomes. And so in the end, there really isn't that much to know about Judas. There may be a clue in his last name, and there's some debate over this. His last name is Iscariot, and there is a theory that that might in some way relate to the Sicarii, the assassins, the sort of radical Jewish zealots who wanted to take up arms against the Roman occupation. There's reason to doubt that translation of his last name, but it is clear, I think, when you look at what little bit of evidence is available, is that Judas was a radical revolutionary, and that it seems somewhat clear that his betrayal of Jesus was the result of his belief that Jesus was not doing what he was supposed to do as the Messiah, right? The Messiah in Judaism does one thing and one thing only. He releases the Jews from occupation and he rebuilds the kingdom of God. And if the Messiah doesn't do those things, then he's not the Messiah. And I think for Judas, that was probably what led to his betrayal, that he really believed that Jesus was the Messiah. And then when he saw that Jesus had no intention of an armed revolution against Rome, that he decided that this was not the Messiah and decided to betray him. Again, a lot of this is conjecture because, frankly, there just isn't that much information about him in the historical sources.
Oh, I see. Well, it's interesting anyway.
Yes.
So you spoke just now about the political nature of the Gospels, of these documents. In your book, you write about Paul's version of Jesus. He depicts Jesus, he writes about Jesus as this sort of apolitical figure, like this universal idea, which anyone can embrace through faith in him. Well, this apolitical Jesus is also a political idea, isn't it?
Yes. I think the remarkable thing about Jesus as, you know, a political figure is that it's really difficult to see him outside of the world in which he lived. And for Paul, I mean, I think people don't realize this, and this is, I think, the most important thing that you can understand about Paul, is that Paul never met Jesus. He never knew Jesus. He never spoke with Jesus. He never followed Jesus. When Jesus was alive and preaching, Paul was a Pharisee. He had no connection to Jesus at all. He never heard of Jesus at all. He wasn't even living in the Holy Land. You know, he's from Tarsus. He's a Roman citizen. He's living up in the north in this fairly wealthy port city. He has no connection to Jesus at all. And so for the apostles, this kind of negates Paul's leadership, right? At the beginning of the book of Acts, right? So Luke, Acts is one book in two parts. It's basically the Gospel of Luke is part one and the book of Acts is part two. And at the end of the Gospel of Luke, Judas betrays Jesus and he dies. And now there's only 11 apostles left. At the beginning of the book of Acts, the first thing that the apostles do is they say, well, we need someone to replace Judas. We need a new apostle. And it's at that moment that they, for the first time, really define what it means to be an apostle. They say, someone who was with the Lord from the beginning, right? One of the original followers who followed him and walked with him and talked with him and preached with him. That's what it means to be an apostle. And they choose lots and they pick one among them.
Basically, well, not Paul.
Not Paul, exactly. Now, here's the interesting thing. Luke, the person who wrote those words, was a disciple of Paul. He was actually Paul's closest companion. And so even Luke, even Paul's closest companion, makes it very clear Paul's not an apostle. And yet, when you read Paul's writings, Paul's letters, he repeatedly refers to himself as an apostle. In fact, he says he's not the 13th apostle, he's the first apostle. Because while Jesus, the man, picked the other 12 apostles you know, by hand. Jesus picked Paul before Paul was even born. He picked Paul while Paul was in the womb, Paul says. He has this grand sense of himself, right? He actually, when confronted with the fact, because he talks about this in his letters, he says, you know, they say I'm not an apostle. And he constantly defends himself. You know, he says that they know Jesus of the flesh. That's how he refers to those who actually knew Jesus when he was alive. And he says, they know Jesus of the flesh, but I know the risen Jesus. So it's really remarkable that this person shows up who, despite never knowing Jesus, becomes probably the most influential of the early Christians. I mean, when you look at the New Testament, more than half the New Testament is either written by Paul or written about Paul. He basically defines Christianity as we know it. And this was a source of great conflict with the rest of the apostles, particularly for Peter, who loathed Paul, called Paul his enemy. And I think for a lot of Christians today, it's difficult to process this, right? We like to think of the early Christians as all being together of one mind, that Peter and Paul were hand in hand preaching together. And that's not true. They actually hated each other. Paul refers to Peter and the rest of the apostles as wolves in sheep's clothing. He says, quote, wow. I learned nothing from them. They mean nothing to me. And when you read the book of Acts, you see over and over again how the apostles are constantly calling Paul back, summoning him, in fact, to answer for some of these strange teachings that he gives. For instance, Paul starts telling people that you don't have to be circumcised anymore. You don't have to follow the law of Moses anymore. And for the apostles, who are Jews, this is outrageous. You know, they call him to constantly correct him on some of these views. And ultimately, I mean, to put it in its simplest way, the reason that Paul has had such an incredible influence on Christianity in a way that, for instance, Jesus's brother James, who led the Jesus movement for some 30 years after Jesus's death, and who was effectively Paul's boss, didn't have, is because James couldn't read and write. Peter could not read or write. None of the apostles could read or write. Paul was an educated Roman citizen. Not only could he read and write, he could read and write in Greek, which was the universal language at the time. And so he actually wrote his beliefs and his views. Whereas Jesus's followers, you know, the people who actually knew him, who grew up with him, who walked with him and talked with him and preached with him during his ministry, they didn't write anything down. And that's honestly the difference, is that we all celebrate Paul as this great founder of Christianity because we have his letters. And we don't have anything of, you know, the rest of the apostles. People wrote down some things for them. We have the letters of James because in James's case, he was a great preacher and people wrote down what he wrote, but he himself couldn't write. Same thing with Peter. And so Paul's version of Christianity, in which Christ is God incarnate, that Christ is this sort of unique being without context, completely apolitical, that's the version of Christianity that has survived, whereas the Christianity of his apostles has more or less died out, except in a few small Middle Eastern sects like the Nestorians, for instance.
So is there anything left of the historical Jesus and of the Jewish Jesus in Christianity today?
Not much, no. But I think, look, in every generation, there have been those who have tried to constantly go back, you know, to that original Jesus, to that radical revolutionary who challenged the greatest empire the world has ever known on behalf of the poor and the dispossessed. And I think that that image of Jesus is one that has lasted for 2,000 years. It's given enormous help and assistance to those who are fighting against the powerful and the elite, the wealthy. And I think it will continue to do so. And you know, all I can hope for is that we continue to remember the Jesus of history and not just the Christ of faith.
Well, okay. Well, thank you very much, Professor Aslan. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you. Is there anything you would like to add?
I hope to be able to come to Brazil soon and speak. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we will be thrilled to have you here. It will be amazing.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much for your time and for your patience. Take care of yourself and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thanks, bud. Talk to you soon.